The Fable at BuzzCedar.org.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM, Minneapolis-St. Paul. Online and archived at KFAI.org. The community's true voice.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, a Central Minnesota Regional Airport gets a new name. Then, how young Minnesotans are making a mark in sustainable agriculture. And drivers of electric vehicles in the Northeast will soon see more charging stations. I'm Chantel Sings. St. Cloud Regional Airport is getting a new name. It's now St. Cloud Sky Central Airport. The change highlights nearly 90 years of aviation history and ongoing regional partnerships. The Airport Authority, formed by Benton, Sherburne, and Stearns counties, along with the City of St. Cloud, has led major upgrades, including new hangars, firefighting equipment, and control tower radios. The airport serves Allegiant and Sun Country flights and averages more than 100 daily takeoffs and landings. In today's main story, as more people seek organic food and products throughout the state, sustainable farmers face consistent challenges on and off the field. Frankie Falegi has more.
Minnesota is home to over 700 organic farms, an increase of over a quarter since nearly a decade ago. The state ranks 10th in the nation for organic farms, and only five Minnesota counties have none as of 2020. Most of the state's organic farms are in central and southeastern Minnesota. Here's one of them.
I am feeding my community.
Heidi Eager is a beginning farmer and owner of Radical Heart Farm in Newburgh Township, Minnesota. Though not certified organic, she raises 100% grass-fed lamb and mutton. Mutton is adult sheep meat. Why? Three main reasons, she says.
Habitat restoration, giving the sheep the best possible life, and then raising really delicious, nutritionally dense food. And the habitat improvement and ecosystem improvement is definitely the thing that, like, keeps me going every day.
Despite decreasing organic acreage statewide, retail demand for organic agriculture has risen substantially in the last two decades, according to the United States Department of Agriculture. More and more people want food and products that don't have synthetic pesticides or fertilizers in them. But it's tough for farmers out there who want to practice sustainable, regenerative practices.
Get big or get out is sort of the mantra. It's like if you aren't competing on the really large scale, then you have to get out.
Josh Yana is in his early 20s, part of a trend of regenerative farmers getting younger and younger. He runs Upward Spiral Goat Service in Henning in western Minnesota. His organic-minded farm had to get creative to stay in the game. It's a unique farming model that allows him to not need much costly farmland.
I think I'm finding a niche as a small farmer because I'm also in the service economy.
He rents out his goat herd to customers who need to eradicate, say, invasive species or a thick brush.
You know, I can have more liquidity, more income than another farmer my size.
Organic farmers, whether certified or not, face financial hurdles. Feed, fuel, and healthcare are the big ones, but there are also on-the-ground struggles like weed management and extreme weather, a 2022 Minnesota legislature report states. Not to mention climate impacts seen more and more every year.
This year, the humidity has been so crazy that there are portions of my pasture that I just cannot graze because the moisture settles there every night. And if I put the sheep in there, the flies get terrible and they start getting infections in their feet. And like, this is not a thing. Like, this is not Missouri. We are not supposed to have this much humidity.
Still, farmers farm on.
Anybody thirsty?
Eager says if more people start farming sustainably, more needs could be met, like halal meat or just more good food. Eager says that's what she's all about. More good food for more good people. For North Star Stories, I'm Frankie Falegi.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Minnesota Power is adding 16 new fast charging stations across northeastern Minnesota to make electric vehicle travel easier and reduce range anxiety for drivers. The first charger debuted in Duluth, with more planned in cities including Hinckley, Park Rapids, and International Falls. Company officials say the expansion supports cleaner transportation and the state's clean energy goals. The chargers are expected to be in service by the end of the year.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's broadcast, the state honors a fallen wildland firefighter. Then, we take a look at Minnesota's precinct caucuses. And an award-winning restaurant is moving to the Guthrie Theater. I'm Gracie J. Governor Tim Walz is honoring wildland firefighter Isabella Bella Grace Oscarson. She died in the line of duty on September 26th. Walz praised Oscarson's courage and dedication, saying her service protected people and nature across Minnesota, Idaho, and beyond. Oscarson served with the Minnesota Conservation Corps, the DNR, and the Idaho Department of Lands. Next, political parties in Minnesota use precinct caucuses, but for many, questions remain about how the process works. For part two of our election coverage, Nock Bowie brings us closer to the state's precinct caucuses.
You may think of voting when it comes to elections, but there's a lot that happens long before Election Day. In Minnesota, it all starts with precinct caucuses.
Forward, backward, inward, outward, come and join the chase. Nothing could be drier than a jolly caucus race.
That's the Alice in Wonderland depiction of a caucus. In the cartoon, the characters are running around in circles with no clear end. In reality, though, these caucuses have a very clear and important purpose.
So this is really about shaping who are the people who represent the party in leadership, but it's also about shaping what are the policies that our party is going to stand for.
Kathleen Cole is a political science professor at Metro State University. Cole says caucuses are also about choosing delegates for higher-level party conventions. In Minnesota, there are only two major political parties that can run these neighborhood-level caucuses, the Democrats and the Republicans. She said caucuses are what make Minnesota's political system unique.
You know, the reason that we have such a history of progressivism in the state of Minnesota and that we're able to elect progressive candidates that have a lot of grassroots support is enabled by our caucus system.
Cole says this grassroots element also makes caucuses different than primaries. Primary elections are when people go to vote for who should represent their party for particular races.
A primary system favors candidates with money, but, you know, because we have this caucus system, it's easier for candidates who have relationships in their communities, who are organizers, but don't necessarily have a lot of money. It's a lot easier for them to get elected.
Despite how fundamental these events are, Roberta Kurth, a longtime caucus participant, says there isn't much awareness about them.
What annoys me the most is that people really don't know what a caucus is, and so there's such a low turnout, and they think it's not important.
Kurth has been involved with the Republican Party in Wabasha County for more than 40 years. She has also volunteered to organize caucuses for her precinct. Kurth went to her first ever precinct caucus back in the 70s, when abortion was a hot-button issue because the Supreme Court had just ruled on Roe v. Wade. After all these years, she remains passionate about caucusing because Kurth says it is where everything begins.
You see how they started in your caucus, they move up to the next convention, and then they go to the state convention, and then perhaps maybe even the national convention. You can see things move through the system.
She's set to volunteer again for the next round of caucuses, which will take place on February 3rd of next year. More information on how to participate in caucuses can be found on the Minnesota Secretary of State website. This is Nock Bowie for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The award-winning restaurant Owamni will move to the Guthrie Theater in downtown Minneapolis in spring 2026. Owamni will occupy the theater's main floor, doubling its current space and continuing to showcase traditional indigenous cuisine. Restaurant founder and chef Sean Sherman said the relocation will strengthen connections to Native food practices and the Mississippi River, while the Guthrie artistic director calls the partnership a milestone for the theater and the riverfront. The move aims to welcome more diners and expand cultural and educational programming.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's stories, Minnesota loses a longtime Twin Cities news anchor. Then, how is food insecurity affecting one of the state's most vulnerable resident groups? And youth leaders defend immigrant access to higher education. I'm Chantel Sings. Veteran Twin Cities journalist Stan Turner has died at age 81. Turner reported the news from KSTP-TV for 35 years and was known for his integrity, curiosity, and signature storytelling voice. A University of Minnesota journalism graduate, he was also honored with a degree in media law from William Mitchell School of Law. A Stan Turner Journalism Scholarship has been established at the University of Minnesota's Hubbard School of Journalism. Next, seniors in Minnesota living on fixed incomes are experiencing new levels of food insecurity. Britt Ahmed looks at two organizations that are trying to fill the gap for Minnesotans age 60 plus.
17% of Minnesota's households with at least one senior citizen are food insecure, according to Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank.
They're facing that even with programs we know that are targeted to meet the needs of seniors, like Meals on Wheels and Social Security, right?
Robin Manthe is Director of Neighbor Services for Second Harvest.
Many of them are working part-time jobs and doing everything they can to extend their income, but there is a point in your life where that isn't an option anymore. And my hope is they can reach out to us at Second Harvest. We have something called a care center where you can call us and we can help you understand your potential eligibility for two core programs.
One is the Commodity Supplemental Food Program, or CSFP,
which is a senior-focused food box with core items, grains, fruits, vegetables, protein, available on a monthly basis.
The other is SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
We can walk you through the eligibility criteria and the application.
Only 40% of eligible Minnesota seniors are enrolled in SNAP. Robin thinks that might be due to an incorrect notion that if they receive the benefit, they'll be taking it out of the mouths of those who need it more.
And actually, having people who are eligible and not participating in the program means we're leaving money on the table that could be coming into our state to support our economy, to invest in local grocery stores, to get more food getting grown locally by farmers. So we know that every dollar that someone gets in SNAP benefits creates a $1.50 of economic benefit in the community.
Rising food costs on a limited budget means that some older Minnesotans are facing food insecurity for the first time as a senior.
When you only have this much money and everything starts costing more, suddenly that much money doesn't go as far.
Susie West is an educator at the University of Minnesota Extension, which, like Second Harvest, connects people to local food shelves.
SNAP, you have to apply, and it can take a while to get approved and get your benefits. Whereas food shelves, if you go to a food shelf, it's because you need food today.
Last year, state food shelves saw a record-breaking 9 million visits, per a report by the nonprofit Food Group.
It's not embarrassing to need help, and that there's literally hundreds of food shelves across Minnesota who would love for you to come in if you need food.
You can find out more at hungersolutions.org and 2harvest.org. This is Britt Ahmed for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Immigrant youth leaders and the Minnesota Attorney General are speaking out against a U.S. Department of Justice lawsuit that could roll back the state's DREAM Act and North Star Promise program. At an event in Minneapolis, students and advocates shared how these programs made college affordable and urged the state to defend them. The Attorney General pledged to protest access to higher education, saying Minnesota should not lead with fear. The programs helped undocumented and low-income students pursue college and strengthen Minnesota's workforce.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Today, federal agents find suspected immigration fraud cases in the Twin Cities. Then, the state honors the life and work of a former legislator. And school officials discover a disturbing enrollment. I'm Gracie J. Federal immigration officers uncovered suspected fraud in 275 cases during Operation Twin Shield, a large-scale investigation across the Twin Cities. Last month, officers reviewed over 1,000 immigration cases, conducted more than 900 site visits, and found signs of fraud or security risks in nearly half of them. The alleged fraud included marriage and family-based petitions, employment authorizations, and certain parole-related requests. Officials say the effort is part of a national initiative to strengthen fraud detection and protect public safety. In today's main story, former Minnesota Senate leader Kari Zijic was known for bringing people together across the aisle. A newly renamed Minneapolis bridge now honors her for doing just that. Here's Ann Holston with the story.
I just wanted to say thank you for joining us today as we dedicate this bridge in memory of Senator Kari Zijic.
During a sunny morning ceremony, State Representative Mohammed Noor joined a who's who of local Democrats in the Dietzic family to honor the longtime lawmaker's service. The 10th Avenue Bridge, spanning the Mississippi River between the University of Minnesota's East and West Bank campuses, now stands as the Minnesota Senate Majority Leader Kari Zijic Memorial Bridge.
She was our strongest leader that we have ever had. The way she bridged communities across party lines and the way she brought people together. This is why we're here today.
Zijic represented Northeast Minneapolis and parts of the University of Minnesota. She was first elected to the Senate in 2012 and won re-election three times before stepping down in early 2024. She died later that year after a two-year battle with ovarian cancer. She was 62.
It is impossible to capture the full measure of Kari in just a few words, but what most stands out about her, in my mind, is her kindness.
State Senator Scott Dibble said Dietzic's compassion was matched by her attention to detail, both in her work and the way she listened to people.
She read every word of every bill. So then when he talked about the page and the line and the chapter, she had those details in her mind.
Colleagues on both sides of the aisle said her level of focus made her one of the legislature's most trusted negotiators, able to win support from unlikely allies. As Senate Majority Leader, Zijic guided one of the most ambitious sessions in recent Minnesota history. Under her leadership, Democrats used their slim majority to pass universal school meals, protect abortion and gender care, legalize recreational cannabis, and create a paid family leave program.
But she did not work to advance her own name or her own career. She completely lacked guile. Kari Zijic was completely about being in service to other people.
Minneapolis City Councilmember Oreen Chowdhury said that spirit inspired a new generation of public servants.
And I know I'm not the only one she gave that first opportunity to. There's just a line of young people who got their start in local government and public service because of Senator Kari Zijic.
Chowdhury said Dietzick's mentorship shaped a community that continues to carry her values forward.
We were very, very lucky to witness it. And we were lucky to know her, and to her family, thank you so much for sharing her with us and the state of Minnesota.
And State Senator Aaron Murphy said Dietzic's leadership was rooted in something deeper than politics.
I think it is important in this moment to remember the human capacity that she brought to this work. Yes, she was a tireless advocate. She knew policy better than anyone, but at her core, she cared about each of us. And that's why we're all here today, to commemorate and honor her with this plaque.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Authorities are investigating an adult man who allegedly used falsified documents to enroll at White Bear Lake High School, northeast of Minneapolis. In a letter to parents, the school principal said staff, students, and families raised concerns that led to the discovery. The man, believed to be over 21, is now in police custody. The incident has prompted safety concerns in the community as officials review how the false enrollment went undetected.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's segment, Minnesota secures a win for crime victims. Then, how the Twin Cities is working to improve responses to domestic violence calls. And health officials report new measles cases across the state. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Attorney General announced that the Trump administration's Department of Justice has dropped plans to impose restrictions based on immigration status for Victims of Crime Act grants. The Attorney General's office led a coalition of 20 states in filing a lawsuit to block the move. The decision secures about $22 million for Minnesota victims and survivors supporting services like emergency shelters, crime scene cleanup, and sexual assault exams. Next, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. In recognition, we're taking a look at a new pilot program aimed at helping the Minnesota Police Department's response to domestic violence calls. Catherine DeSalle has more.
He told the world that he was going to kill her.
That's Yvonne Winston, cousin of Mariah Samuels, a Minneapolis woman who was shot and killed by her ex-boyfriend after he posted threatening messages on social media, stalked her, and assaulted her on camera.
Her assailant was on federal and state parole.
In August, Mariah Samuels filed charges and was granted a protective order against her abuser.
Once Mariah received that order of protection, he should have automatically been violated. He should have been arrested prior to the murder.
Yvonne says Mariah did everything that she was supposed to do to get out of an abusive relationship.
The parole officer was aware that he was committing these crimes. When he beat Mariah 3 days before her death, she assumed that charges were being pressed, that he would be charged and picked up for assaulting her.
Days before her death, Mariah Samuels posted on her public Facebook page video from her doorbell camera of her abuser beating her. And just minutes before she died, Mariah posted how frustrated she was with the police not doing anything to protect her.
I don't understand what more they needed to remove this criminal from the streets. They failed to protect her from the top of the Minnesota Department of Corrections to the Federal Bureau of Parole to the Minneapolis Police.
Only 20% of Minneapolis domestic violence calls result in an official report or arrest. This according to a 2017 study done by the Minneapolis Police Conduct Oversight Commission.
We want domestic violence survivors to have different experiences, to have better experiences.
That's Amethany Keefe of the Domestic Abuse Project in Minneapolis. She's part of a group that created the Domestic Violence Response Team, a new process that helps the Minneapolis Police Department, or MPD, better serve survivors.
In July, our partners in MPD trained up all of the officers in the 4th Precinct. They began utilizing this new process and this new risk assessment document.
The new assessment document helps police ask better questions during domestic calls. That information is then shared with the judicial system and domestic violence specialists, ideally connecting victims to more resources and helping the courts hold offenders responsible for their actions.
They're limited in the number of police officers that they have to respond. We have these different system partners that are involved and advocates are involved because we recognize that we all have opportunities for making changes.
The Domestic Violence Response Team pilot program recently expanded in hopes of saving more lives from domestic violence.
For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Department of Health, or MDH, is urging families to check their vaccinations after confirming 10 new measles cases, bringing the state's total to 18 this year. 7 of the recent cases were within families who had recent domestic travel and were related to 3 other cases already reported. 3 additional cases were tied to international travel. Initial symptoms of measles include a fever, cough, runny nose, and watery eyes, followed by a rash. More information about measles can be found on the MDH Measles website.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News.
I'm Marie Rock. This week, a look at the recent Tribal Flag Plaza flag-raising ceremony at the state capitol. Plus, what the first cohort of the Minnesota Historical Society's Native American Museum Fellowship Program are up to. First, let's hear from producer Deanna Standing Cloud.
A brisk chill surged across the lawn in front of the Minnesota State Capitol on a bright September morning. Over 300 people gathered to celebrate the opening of the new Tribal Flag Plaza.
So much has changed, and yet there's still so much to change.
For some Native people in Minnesota, this celebration is long overdue, including Ojibwe elder Sharon Day.
You know, this big building behind us. Today we have flags. Maybe down the road, there'll be a building representing tribal governments right over there. Yeah?
The recognition of tribal nations in the state capitol also brings up reminders of broken treaties. Tribal chairman of the Upper Sioux, Peji Hutazizi Oyate Indian Community, Kevin Jensvold, says he has mixed feelings.
It is a good thing, but I also have to acknowledge another time of my grandfather's grandfather, the people who lived upon this land long before any immigrant ever came.
In 1851, the Dakota were forcibly made to enter into treaties with the United States government, with the promise that the first reservation lands in Minnesota would be held for them to live on in exchange for millions of acres of land.
And a truth that exists: in order for these flags to fly today, something had to be given up.
There is a deep sense of pride that comes along with the waving of the Minnesota tribal flags, one of survival, identity, and inherent sovereignty. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Deanna Standing Cloud.
Next, the Minnesota Historical Society recently wrapped up its first Native American Museum Fellowship cohort. Producer Dan Ninham talks with two of the fellows.
Community to me means everything. It's our relatives, it's our neighbors, it's our loved ones, it's our knowledge keepers, our storytellers.
That was Haley Cherry, Ho-Chunk and Winnebago, the Native American Museum Fellows Program Administrative Assistant, based at the Minnesota Historical Society.
The focus of the Native American Museum Fellowship is to provide Natives the opportunity to dive into a lot of the different fields in museum work. It's really about recreating those narratives and telling our own stories with our own voice.
The Native American Museum Fellows Program is 10 weeks long.
So a prerequisite is that you do have an interest in museum or heritage studies. We've recently opened it up to community scholars so they can take what they learn from the fellowship and better fit those practices to their tribes in a way that's going to make museums more accessible.
That was Genesis Fonder, Native American Museum Fellows Program Specialist.
I'm from the Mille Lacs Band. I have paternal ties to Leech Lake through my grandpa, but I also grew up as like a city Indian. And it wasn't until I began working for my tribe within the chief's office that I really began to reconnect with my community.
I would say that is really one of the biggest pieces of the program, is to be able to touch and care for these items and collections, but also to be able to get out and be in touch with the land.
For Haley, this part of the program allows fellows to connect to the living spirit of these objects when visiting different sites and museums statewide and nationally.
We've had a fellow help with the restoration of a birch bark canoe, so traditional restoration.
Genesis recognizes that there are challenges with getting community involved in museum work, including engaging young people.
They don't necessarily see it as work that brings them closer to their ancestors.
There are still spots open in the Native American Museum Fellows Program. More information is available at mnhs.org. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Dan Ninham.
Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Support for KFAI comes from Crooner's Supper Club, presenting Philip Michael Scales, Thursday, October 23rd. guitarist, singer, songwriter, and nephew of B.B. King, Philip Michael Scales has dubbed his particular style Dive Bar Soul. After opening national tours for Kep Moe and Caravan Palace, he teamed up with producer Dan Knobler for his latest release, Good to Be Here. As Philip Michael Scales puts it, I wouldn't say that I've arrived, but it's good to be here. More information about Philip Michael Scales